let's get into this. So we've started this sermon series. It's a trusting God with my dot, dot, dot. And the one that I'm doing is trusting God with my future. Or trusting God with your future. Trusting God with our future. And I'm just going to say right off the bat, I think this is a weird one. Because I think the future is really strange. And I've made a little graph to sort of prove my point here. Let's see if it comes up. Okay, so the future is strange to me. I struggle with it sometimes. I made a graph here. We got 9-year-old Benny, 19, 29, 49, and 79-year-old Benny. And we're looking at the timelines of what they think about each other. So 9-year-old Benny thinks of himself as a talented cutie. That's for real. It's embarrassing now, but that is definitely what I thought of myself at the time. I thought 19-year-old Benny would be a tap dancing superstar. I thought that 29-year-old Benny would be a global children's author. And the 49-year-old Betty, well, probably Jesus has already come back at that time, so it doesn't really count. Then we've got 19-year-old Benny. He thinks that 9-year-old Benny is a chubby nerd. He thinks that he is an adventurous free spirit. And that by 29 years old, probably going to make it as a global media mogul and then shift into global ministries at about 49 years old and probably be dead by 79. Then we got 29-year-old Benny, who is much wiser. I like this guy more than the others. And he thinks that 9-year-old Benny was a lucky kid. 19-year-old Benny was definitely mischievous. Not such a great kid. 29-year-old Benny is a sensible apprentice church planter. And at about 49 years old, 29-year-old Benny expects to see 49-year-old Benny leading multi-campus church ministry programs. And then by 79 years old, I will be publishing books as a thought leader for global ministry, hoping to get those royalty dollars to pay for my grandkids' college education, buy the lake houses, etc., etc. So we have all these different versions of Benny through our time, and we got 49-year-old Benny and 79-year-old Benny. I don't know what they think about me. I don't know what they think about this Benny. I don't even know if they exist. I don't know anything about those guys because they're in the future. I mean, I'm guessing that they're real. I'm guessing that they're there, and maybe they think about me, but I don't know them. I can't reach into the future, and that's what I find so strange about the future is we all expect it. We all talk about it, know about it. We all, I guess, believe in the future. And it's really just a millisecond away, or less than a millisecond away, but we can't touch it. We can't reach out and change anything there. It's just there, I guess. It's so strange to me. And even in the past, I'm just sort of just reaching back to little bits. And I even skew it based on my perspective right now, what I think the past is about. Now, what's weird to me is my opinion of the past and future changes based on my present perspective. But for God, it's not like that. He doesn't remember. He doesn't predict. He observes all of it, all in a row, all these Bennies at once. Because God exists outside of time. He sees Benny as one whole from the beginning to the end. One thing that I find really cool about that is that he can hear our praise. And when he hears our praises, he doesn't just hear this morning's praise, but he can hear all of the praise sung to him over all of history. Isn't that cool to think of that? A little less cool to think of is that he could see all of sin committed in all of history, all at once, the terrible, terrible things that have happened in the world. He's able to see that damage, not just moment by moment, but all of it at once, how it all culminates together. And another thing I find cool and interesting, actually before moving on, isn't it really good to know that there is nothing you can do to surprise Jesus with your sin? Everything that you've ever done that he died to save you from, he knew about before you did it. He knew what he was in for, what he was purchasing, what he was saving before you did it. There's things that you're going to do yet in your life that he's already forgiven. Another cool thing is that when he hears our prayers, he doesn't just hear it moment by moment, responding to the present. Not just that, but he's able to listen to the prayers of our life and respond to our life needs, the complete person. So in this way, God sort of knows us even better than we know ourselves. Because I've got opinions about 9-year-old Benny and 79-year-old Benny, but God gets to see all of it at once. Pretty cool. Does that make sense? No. It's very weird. It's very strange that God is outside of time. I don't understand it at all. It's very difficult to wrap my head around that. And when I got started on this sermon topic, it didn't take very long for me to just warp my brain, scratch my head. And so I had to return to something, just something that I could relate to. So I settled with a question like this. I think we can relate to it. It says, does God care enough about me to give me the future I want? I think that's something we can relate to. Does God care enough about me to give me the future I want? Is he powerful enough? Am I even on his agenda? After all, in Psalm 37, 3-4, it says that he'll give us the desires of our heart. Okay, now while we wait for Journey, we're going to do a little exercise. I would like everybody to take out their journal and open to a blank page. I know you didn't bring a journal with you, a lot of you. It's okay. The journal I'm talking about is actually an imaginary journal. It is your deepest secret heart journal. It's tucked away inside your heart. This is an imaginary process. So I want you to close your eyes or in your mind's eye, take out a journal. Thanks, bud. Take out that journal. Here, look, it might look like this, except for in your imagination. And take it out and open it up to a blank page. Take out a pen. And I want you to write in your imaginary journal three words. The first word is going to be one of your deepest desires. The ones that nobody knows about. That's what we're going for here. Your deepest desires. You're never going to tell anybody. It's just in there. Write that down in your deepest secret heart journal. Number two, another deepest desire. The desires of your heart. Write another one down. And number three, another one. Three words that describe three of your deepest heart desires. Tuck that away in your deepest secret heart journal. And just put it back there. It's really small. Just put it back inside your heart. It's imaginary, by the way. Don't try to put anything inside your heart. Just an imaginary place to keep your deepest secret heart desires. We're going to come back to that. All right. So back to our question. Anyone who believes in a higher power probably has pondered this question at some point. But if we dig into this question like we're going to do right now, we're going to come up with a problem pretty fast. And that's because we have two sort of conflicting assumptions. Assumption number one is God cares about people and is powerful enough to do something for them. That's an assumption that we haven't talked about here yet. God has a lot to say on this subject. This is a Bible right here. You can also get it on the internet and on apps for free. It's a really big book. It's actually a series of 66 books, and it's been compiled over about 3,500 years. And God has made it really easy for us to reference things that he wants us to know. And inside that book is a lot that you can read about how God cares about people and how he is powerful enough to do something for them. So I'm just going to say some of my favorites. Actually, let's just do one. Matthew 6:25. Also, I'm going to try to go as fast as I possibly can today. And I'm actually going to be up here again next week, and I'll get to slow down a little bit on some of this stuff next week. So we're looking at Matthew chapter 6, verse 25. Matthew is the first book of the New Testament. Hey, you've got, if you don't have a Bible with you or an app that you can get on the internet, you do have a Bible in the seat in front of you. It's tucked behind that seat. Matthew chapter 6, verse 25 to 34. Let's read a little bit about God caring about people, powerful enough to do something for them. Matthew 6, 25. Therefore, I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat, what you will drink, nor your own body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body, and more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his lifespan? And why are you anxious about clothing? Consider the lilies. They neither toil nor spin, and yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is alive and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not also clothe you much more? O you of little faith, therefore do not be anxious, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the Gentiles seek after these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. He knows that you need them all. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Therefore, don't be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient is the day for its trouble. Good passage. All right, so we see a little bit. That's just a little bit. The Bible's full of that stuff, showing us how God cares about people, and he's powerful enough to do something with for them. Okay, that's one assumption dealt with. Another assumption is, the future that I want God to give me will still be what I want when I arrive in the future. Bit of a complex sentence. Try to simplify it a little bit. The future that I want is actually what I want. That's an assumption that we make. We make an assumption saying that what I want for me is actually good for me. It's what I will still want when I get it. And that assumption has holes. So we could make a new question. If God is powerful enough, would he give us what we want? And if not, what does Psalm 37, 2 to 4 mean? Let's take a look at Psalm 37, 2 to 4. Psalm 37, 2 to 4. This is what it says. Let's go 3, actually. Psalm 37, 3. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land. This is Psalm 30. Yes. I don't think I'm reading the right thing. Ah, yes, I am. I am reading the right thing. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. He will give you the desires of your heart. So if God is powerful enough, would he give us what we want? Is what we want the right thing for us? Will we still want it in the future? And if not, then what does Psalm 37:4 mean by God giving us the desires of our heart? So before I had even started any study, my thoughts about this sermon topic were starting to fray. This was getting weird as I thought about the future and how God might bless us and what he's going to do to bless our future. So I needed to find something concrete I could follow. So what I decided is I'm going to follow the evolution of Peter's attitude towards the future. Peter is a really likable guy in the Bible. He's a pretty normal guy. He's also a little bit of a goof at times. He's a very colorful character. And he's a friend of Jesus. He's a close friend of Jesus and a disciple. So I wanted to see, okay, how is this guy who's hanging out with Jesus, how is his attitude towards the future changing over time? Because I just needed to find something to wrap my head around this concept of trusting God with the future. And what I found as I read the book of Mark, what I was doing is I was circling every single word that referenced the future, like let, will, if, shall, would, must, that kind of stuff. I was circling it and finding all the bits where Jesus taught about the future, or he made references to the future, or other people and their questions about the future towards Jesus. And because the book of Mark is a gospel account, which means a historical report of Jesus' life, while I was reading through all these sections of Jesus' teaching, there was absolute gold. I was finding heaps. I found, well, here's what I found. I found two really simple principles about how to trust God with the future. And I thought, piece of cake. This sermon's going to be easy. It's all laid out right here. Two principles about how we can trust God. But then as I kept reading through Mark, Jesus' teaching ministry kind of shifts into the Gospel of Mark telling about Jesus' death and resurrection. Really different. It sort of even takes this dark turn as you're reading through the Gospel of Mark. And then as I read on, I found one monumental principle about not how but why we should trust God with our future. Now, this part was not easy for me to take on board. It affected me in a big way. It affected me emotionally. It affected my faith. It affected my joy. And I just thought, wow, this is so, so good. I don't know if I can do all this in one sermon. So we're gonna like maybe spread it out over two. But hopefully in this sermon, I'll be able to share with you exactly what God did to my heart when I found this incredible principle that was coming through in the life of Jesus and Peter. So we're going to race through these two principles so we can try to get to this one monumental why. And we're going to take a deeper dive into all those things next week. But first, let's take a look at the life of Peter and sort of get our bearings on the ground. So we're looking at the evolution of Peter's attitude toward the future. And just like I did with all the different versions of Benny, I've got that going on with Peter here. Peter is about 18 to 20 years old when he's meeting Jesus. And I would frame the guy as a winner, a go-getter. He's impetuous, and sometimes he's a little too keen. But I really admire Peter's faith. Peter is the guy in your life that if you can't decide, you know him, you love hanging out with him, but you can't decide if you're going to bring him along to a party because it could go really well. He could be the life of the party and everyone will love him and you have a great time, or he could do something ridiculously embarrassing and you just never get invited back. That's the kind of guy Peter is. When he sees something amazing, he just has to be a part of it. He just jumps right into it. Peter is actually the guy that stepped out of the boat and walked on the water with Jesus. He said, "Jesus, if that's you, then you tell me to come out there and I'll come out there with you." That's our Peter that we're looking at here. A likable dude, and Jesus really liked him. But then in Mark chapter 8, we start to see a difference between Peter's attitude toward the future and, sorry, Peter's attitude towards the future and Jesus' attitude towards the future. Because Jesus tells the disciples what's about to happen. Jesus tells the disciples about his imminent crucifixion. And get this, young Peter, pretty young guy, actually takes Jesus, God incarnate, aside and rebukes him. "Hey, Jesus, not on my watch. You're not gonna be dying while I'm around. Good on you, Peter." Actually, Jesus takes it really seriously. The thing is, Peter has plans. Peter wants to go places. He has big ideas. You could call him a zealot because he wants to win. He wants to hit it big time. And weakness, forfeit, death, those things are not allowed in Peter's agenda. And Jesus was contradicting his plans. Jesus was talking about death and crucifixion. These are things that represent weakness to Peter. He doesn't want any of that. So Peter says, no, we're not doing any of that. And Jesus' response to him is pointed. It's actually jarring in the text as you read it. I'm not gonna read the whole thing. I'll wait for you to stumble upon that one yourself. But Jesus' response is very pointed. And he basically says, Peter, you're not setting your mind on the things of God. You're focused on the things of man, just like the devil. And if God says that we're going to die, we're going to die. And if you're not willing to take hold of God's promises, then you can't follow me. Ouch. Peter is getting reamed out for attempting to avoid death. That's crazy. What's going on here? All right, we'll get to that later. But in Peter's timeline, let's get these up here. So Peter follows Jesus. He's rebuked by Jesus. I got the passages up there for you. It's obviously had an effect on Peter, what Jesus has said, because in Mark 14, Peter says, okay, Lord, all right, I didn't get it. Now I get it. I'm ready. I am ready to die for you. In fact, if they try to come and get you, they're going to have to kill me first. That's how ready I am. And this is a very pivotal part in Peter's life because of what's going to happen in just a few hours. Jesus is arrested, and Peter, having just declared that he will die fighting to keep Jesus alive, Peter runs away. He denies Jesus. Peter, the faithful zealot, is reduced to a coward, and it even seems that he's forfeited his inspiring faith in Jesus. Feel that. Feel that disappointment that he feels in him, in himself. So, Jesus is crucified. He conquers sin and death, and Jesus is raised to life. But all the confidence and self-assurance in Peter's future seems to dissolve into this faithless funk for Peter for days, maybe even weeks. So Jesus approaches Peter. Jesus has already won. Jesus has already done what needs to be done in his ministry on the cross. And he approaches Peter, and I think this is in Luke 24 and Acts 1-4. Jesus asks Peter and the rest of the disciples to wait on God for power from on high. So, moving down the timeline here, Peter followed Jesus. Guy's got super faith. He rebukes Jesus. That wasn't a great idea, but he changes his ways, ready to die for Jesus. Oops, drops the ball big time. He denies Jesus. And now Jesus is saying, wait for power from on high. And then something happens. Peter is waiting, and he's waiting with this realization that his version of the future was really just a fiction. He had things planned out. It didn't happen that way. But then God's Spirit shows up in power and glory, and Peter finds a glorious joy that he just can't contain, and he actually stands up and he preaches what is maybe the most bold sermon in the history of all mankind as he stands up and preaches Jesus to a crowd that just weeks ago crucified Jesus. He preaches Jesus' power to them. And he tells them to repent and to follow Jesus, and they do. And that day, 3,000 people come to faith in Jesus because of this joy that inspired Peter to stand up and be bold and share what Jesus had given him. The rest of Peter's life is filled with lots more of the same moments of humiliation as he discovers and as he leads others to know more of the glory of God. So he goes through social humiliation, he goes through jail, he goes through torture, and even actually there's a time when he's called out by other people in the church for some hypocrisy in his life, Peter continues to have all these times in his life where he's being called in humiliation. He's being humbled, and he is growing in joy this whole time, all the way up to finally he is killed for his faith. But before that happens, before he's killed for his faith, he makes this statement in 1 Peter 4:19. And actually, I have the passage up here on the screen, and I want you to notice that I have a dot, dot, dot that leaves out a couple of passages here. I hope to get to those passages next week. They're big passages, and I wouldn't be able to unpack them right now. But we're going to look at verse 12 and verse 19 of 1 Peter 4. It says this: "Rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed." This is a guy who continually finds how in love he is with God through his weaknesses. "Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good." This is a man who knows real suffering. He knows what it's like to lose. He knows what it's like to be depressed. And he's saying, this is a time for joy. What is going on? He's not faking it. There's nothing for him to gain by saying this. He takes it to the grave. He's either a crazy person, or no, he can't be a crazy person, because all these other people are coming to faith and are growing in faith in the exact same way. So what's going on here? Recap. Peter starts with an admirable faith. We just did this. He rebukes Jesus. His future plans conflict with Jesus, and he determines that he's going to correct his path, but he falls short. And with nothing left to give, he waits on God, and through faith he finds power from above. Power from above. By faith he finds power from above that outmeasures his future plans. I said that a bunch of times because I want you to get that. Through faith, he finds power from above that outmeasures his future plans. I hope you see where this is going. Do you kind of feel like you're getting where this is going? Okay, that's really good. Graciously, over time, God is slowly growing Peter's faith through moments of loss. Measure by measure, bit by bit, God is wedging open Peter's heart to know more of his glory, to know more of the joy that God gives. Bit by bit, God is wedging open his heart. But before all of this becomes obvious to Peter, before he's able to teach about it later on in his life, Peter was experiencing it in Jesus' ministry. And that's our cue to take a look at those two principles, those two how principles. And we're going to revisit these again next week, but we're just going to touch on them now. So let's rewind to Jesus' ministry and take a look at those principles. Principle number one, Jesus tells a bunch of parables in his teaching ministry. Parables, analogies. It's like when he's doing that, it's like Jesus is saying, look, the future belongs to God. It's a really big idea. He's got it under control, and I got to tell you, it's over your heads. I'll give you a little picture of what's going on. I'll make it something like a farm situation or a house situation, something that you're used to. But the future is big, and it's over your heads. And then Jesus would do this thing where he would turn virtually every future concern into an issue of present faith. So, are you concerned about how you're going to eat in the future? Or are you concerned about hungry people in the future? Share your food now. Have faith that God's given you enough to share now. Are you concerned with people's health in the future? Your health in the future, will faithfully seek God and how he shapes a healthy life now. Are you concerned with future growth? Are you concerned with questions? Then listen to God today and be faithful with his instructions for today. Are you concerned with whether or not you'll be alive in the future? Well, faithfully listen to God who gives life today. So Jesus is constantly turning a future concern into a present faithfulness. That's principle number one. Principle number two, entrust your future to the one who is trustworthy. Now, when I was writing this down, I was concerned. I was a little bit worried because we don't like this bit. It has a flip side. If I say this in the negative, it is much less tasteful. It is much less palatable. Do not entrust your future to the one who is untrustworthy. You see, Peter had really high hopes for himself. In Mark 14:29, he says, "Jesus, they might fall, the other disciples might fall, but I won't fall." Peter had real high hopes, but in the end, he did fall. And then he waited on God, and he found that God came to him and renewed his strength and renewed him to glorious joy. Peter couldn't trust his own desires. He couldn't trust his own desires to bring him to the place that he wanted to be in the future, but he could trust God. 19-year-old Benny looks back at 9-year-old Benny and thinks, "I'm not going to trust that guy with anything. He's a doofus." 33-year-old Benny looks back at 19-year-old Benny and says, "That's a mean thing to say, 19-year-old Benny. You're a doofus." Who knows what 49-year-old Benny is going to look back at 33-year-old Benny and say? What will 49-year-old Maggie look back at 33-year-old Benny and say about this sermon? The reality is, I've learned now that I can't trust this guy. I can't trust him to make great decisions about the future. The Bible talks about Jesus being offensive at times to those who don't have faith, and this is why. It's because God has a clear view into our sin. So he sees what we are made for because he sees what the complete and perfect picture of us would be because he created us. He knows what we're meant for, and he made us to find pleasure in him. He made us to find maximum satisfaction in him, and he calls sin what it is. Sin is robbing God, it's robbing the world, and it's robbing ourselves of the joy that God intended for us to have. You are a creature of pleasure by design. God intends great pleasure for you, but that pleasure is warped when you try to get the pleasure, that God-sized pleasure, without God, apart from God, apart from his purposes. That's called abuse. Our attempts to find God-sized joy from creation rather than from the Creator result in abuse. And God does not turn a blind eye to crimes like that. He loves you, but he doesn't wink an eye at abuse and brush it under the rug of the past. Someone has to pay for the penalty of sin that we have accrued. Jesus paid that debt for us. If you would trust him with the payment, he would do that for you. It's actually already done. That is in the past. Jesus has paid the penalty of sin. God still wants you to enjoy all of his glory, free from the presence of sin forever. That is yours to inherit, a place that is free from the presence of sin from ever. If you would trust him, that's secured. It's in God's future. He has that secured, ready for you. It belongs to him in the future. That's his kingdom. All that's left now is to accept what God is doing in your life today. Graciously, God is slowly growing your faith get this, through moments of loss, taking away the things that you've come to depend on, that you've come to entrust your future into. He's taking those things away, slowly, bit by bit, measure by measure, wedging open your heart so that you can know more and more of His glory and joy that lasts forever, that nothing can take away, will never fail. There's something hard about hearing that. There's something hard about hearing that you want things for your future that God doesn't want to give you because He has something better in store for you. It's hard, kind of feels like dying, because we hate losing something that makes us feel good, especially if we're not the ones deciding to give it away. Even if we know it's bad, we hate giving that up. When we're subject to sin, we say to God, God, help me, please. I just need to get this thing. I just need to survive. God, can't you please give me this thing? And I want you to hear that sometimes God says, oh, my child, I love you too much to give that to you. I have bigger, better plans for you than just to survive. Right now, you're drunk on your fictional future, but I've got something so much better for you. I've created you for glorious joy. Please, I'm not going to give it to you now. I'm going to take that away, and I want you to trust in me instead. I've got something much better for you. He asks us to trust Him with what He is bringing into our lives. But He's so gracious. God is so gracious because He does this bit by bit. So we'll get to that passage in a second. Sorry, I made the text very small. I didn't know it would be that small. You should get your smartphone out and zoom in, take a photo, check this stuff later. So from the beginning of Peter's faith journey, all the way to his execution are these ever-increasing moments of grace that continually stretch the perimeters of his faith so that measure by measure, bit by bit, Peter's faith grows and grows and grows until it has grown to a place where he finds joy in suffering, even to the point where he can die for Jesus, knowing that he is winning. He's receiving joy even in that act. But why? Why does God want to grow our faith? What's wrong with a small faith? Why? Jesus says that faith as big as a mustard seed can move a mountain. Why can't we keep it small? Because the more we trust God, the more we get to experience the joy of where He's leading us next. Jesus says in Mark 4:24, pay attention to what you hear. With the measure you use, it will be measured to you, and even more will be added to you. So the challenge here for you is to see what measure God is calling you to next. He's so gracious. He does it bit by bit, measure by measure. Trust me here. Just see. Just wait on me and see what happens. Okay. Wow. I said that this was monumental to me this week. And I'm going to tell you why. I have to take the lid off because I put hot tea in here and I sipped it before and it burned me. But my mouth is really dry, so I'm hoping to get it. Okay. So I'm going to tell you a story about me. It was very emotional this week. I hope to do this fast and not too emotionally. I think I am a task magnet. I attract to-dos, to-do items. I get really, really busy because I enjoy it. I enjoy getting things done. And July has been ripe with opportunities to squeeze in more achievements, which is great. I love achievements. I find great satisfaction in achievements. But on Wednesday morning this week, I was stressing out as I was driving to work. I live in Willow Point. I work downtown. Right along the ocean is my drive. Right at the corner of the Island Highway and Rockland, there's a lot of road work going on. It's about 8:45 in the morning, and I can't believe that there is one time in the history of all mankind that there is gridlock traffic in Campbell River, and that was at this very moment. And I was thinking as I was waiting in the traffic about my workload piling up. I had staff taking holidays and all the things that I got to get done, and I had to work so many overtime hours while my wife was sick and she needs my help at home, and I want to go home and get these things done, and my health goals are taking a nosedive because I'm trying to squeeze in a workout and it's not working out, and my devotionals have been so sparse, I'm not getting enough of those in, and I was supposed to do the music today. I said yes to that, but I double booked it with this sermon, so I couldn't do both, and I'm trying to plan this ministry team on the side, and I got to write this sermon sometime during the week, and I realized as I'm sitting in the car, it felt like I was holding these achievements that I was so looking forward to feeling satisfied over, and they were just slipping through my hands like sand. And I felt the sadness of losing something that I really wanted. Good things on my to-do list. I just couldn't get them all done. Started to feel sad about it. But then I heard the words of God say this: my grace is sufficient for your need. My power is made perfect in your weakness. Said it to me in the car. And I started weeping in gridlock traffic, cars everywhere, people looking at me, and I'm sobbing like a baby man. But they weren't tears of sorrow. And I really want to tell you why. That morning, I had been reading, I think it was Mark chapter 15, Jesus crucified. And the crowd was yelling at Jesus as he was hanging from the cross, his body all torn up. He was paying the ultimate price for them. And the crowd called to him and said, if you really are the Messiah, if you really are our Savior, then take yourself down off the cross. Prove it. Prove what you've got. Prove your power. He could have done it. He had the power. He could have done it. But he decided to stay in that place of deep, deep loss. Why? Why did he do it? Why did he stay in that place of deep, deep loss? Think of that answer in your head right now. Why did he do that? And check out Hebrews 12, chapter 12, verse 2. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2. Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising its shame. Did you catch that? Why was Jesus doing this? Why was he faithfully staying in deep, deep loss? It was the joy that was set before him. Jesus was looking forward to something that outweighed the loss that was going on right now. The next part of the passage says that he was seated at the right hand of God. That was the next move for him. He was going to experience this loss and wait for the Father and then be seated in heaven, the King of heaven. Jesus trusted, even in the midst of great loss. And he was delivered to great, great joy. Hey, you are part of that joy. He wanted you to have you in his kingdom. That was part of his joy. And so as I'm sitting in my car, feeling this sadness about my loss, I realized, he's doing it right now. He's doing it to me. I have this loss, this thing that I want, and I can't have it. And he is asking me to put my faith in him. And I'm going to experience something that is better than what I'm going to lose. Man, changed everything. It changed everything. It changed. It didn't just change that moment. That changed decades of wondering what God was doing in my life. To know that when something I lose like that, is God replacing it with an opportunity to find joy in him? And I realized that the only thing that I have ever lost was all the opportunities that I didn't take to entrust him with more of my heart. Graciously, God was slowly growing my faith through this moment of loss, measure by measure, bit by bit, wedging open my heart to know more and more of his glory and joy. In Campbell River Baptist Church, I really pray from the bottom of my heart that as God calls you to those places this week and for the rest of your life, that you remember to wait on God and trust him with your future. He has great joy for you. Now, we're going to end. I notice the band isn't up here. As the band comes up here, I want you to use your imagination again and go back into your mind's eye. Reach back into your heart and take out your deepest, darkest, secret heart journal. And I want you to look at those three things that you wrote down on that blank page deep inside. And whenever you're ready, I want you to take an imaginary pen and cross those out without any concern. Just happy to wait and see what God is going to do with those things. He wants to give you the deepest desires of your heart. You don't even know what they are yet. You couldn't even choose them if they were right in front of you. He's working them in you. Even today, he's working them in you, calling you to a greater measure of faith today. And that is my prayer for you.